This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The Mueller investigation gave us insights into how Paul Manafort and his business partner Rick Gates hid their ill-gotten money with the help of shell companies and real estate, protecting it from the reach of the law until the investigation. Crooks, oligarchs, kleptocrats, and some of the super rich from around the world use this transnational shadow system of shell companies and real estate to stash their money. My guest journalist Oliver Bullough calls this transnational shadow world Moneyland. His new book is called Moneyland, The Inside Story of the Crooks and Kleptocrats Who Rule the World. As part of his work trying to expose this system, he runs kleptocracy tours in London, which we'll talk about later. Bullough is a regular contributor to The Guardian and is the author of two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics. He lived in and reported from Russia in the early 2000s. Oliver Bullough, welcome to Fresh Air. So just give us a brief description. What is Moneyland? What do you mean when you use that original coinage?
Thanks very much for having me. Moneyland is a country I invented. It doesn't exist in the way that any normal country does, but it's basically the place where you can put your money, you can put your reputation, you can put your children, if you are rich enough to afford its services. And it is essentially a hybrid country that exists outside of ordinary nation states, where the power of law enforcement doesn't stretch to. So it's a secret country, a private country for anyone rich enough to afford its services. And it's essentially government sort of the rich, for the rich, by the rich.
And it's a country, in quotes, that includes many, many countries around the world that specialize in various things to hide ill-gotten money.
Yes, it's a sort of portmanteau country. So you use little bits of the laws of many countries and you create something that's much more powerful, much greater than the sum of its collective parts. So that might be, you know, you use a shell company somewhere like the British Virgin Islands, and then you add that to something like a trust in South Dakota, and then you've arranged all that via a lawyer in London, and you've holding your money in a bank in I don't know, Singapore. And essentially any one of those structures would be vulnerable to the sort of attack from law enforcement or a business rival or whatever. But when taken together, essentially it becomes almost entirely impregnable, because no one can afford to combat all of those different countries' legal systems simultaneously and unlock all the protections that the different countries give you.
And so, like, this is good news for the super wealthy who hide their money through these vehicles with the help of other countries, through offshores and trusts and tax havens, dummy companies. But you say it's damaging to democracy, too. How are these offshores and secret ways of keeping money damaging to democracy?
Well, I mean, to explain that, I suppose it's important to back up a little bit and talk about where the idea came from and where I started work. I'm a kind of Russianist, a former Soviet Unionist, if that's a word I can use, pretty ugly word. But it's essentially I came to this from having reported on sort of war and human rights abuses and degradation in the old Soviet Union. And I suppose when I first went there, as a sort of naive, very early 20-something, sort of slightly thinking that I was going to be reporting on democratic transformation and the flowering of a new society and the spread of democracy all across Europe. But instead, you know, I saw the spread of corruption and sort of increasingly authoritarian governments and all that. And it became, I suppose, Moneyland was my attempt to explain and to understand why, instead of becoming democracies, instead of becoming, you know, ordinary European countries, these states, the republics of the old Soviet Union, went off in a very different direction and instead became dominated by these anti-democratic elites, these kleptocrats, oligarchs, people who really stole a huge amount of the country's resources. And so why Moneyland and what is sort of inimical to democracy and why the sort of offshore finance that this is based in is inimical to democracy is because the core function of any democratic government, and this I think is something that gets lost in a lot of the debate, the core function of a democratic government is to tax its citizens for the common good of everyone. That is what a democratic government is for. It essentially, with the consent of the governed, it taxes its citizens and then it uses that money for everyone's good. If a class of society is able to opt out of that contract, if they will essentially enjoy the privileges of citizenship without any of the obligations of citizenship, then they are opting out of democracy. And if they are ruling the country, then that means that a democracy falls. That's why it's anti-democratic, because the governments of these countries are unable to tax their wealth. They're unable to essentially impose any obligations on them as citizens. And instead, they get to enjoy all the benefits of citizens without any of the, you know, what might be termed the downsides.
Well, draining a lot of the money from the country and stashing it in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, incredible amounts of money is being drained, because this isn't only a problem that afflicts the former Soviet Union. This is something that, as I realized while researching this book, I started out in Ukraine and Russia and Azerbaijan and so on. I realized increasingly that the from the money's point of view, it doesn't really matter what language a country speaks. It's all international. So it might be money from Nigeria, might be money from Angola, might be money from Malaysia or China or Indonesia, India. The money always essentially ends up in the same place, which is Moneyland, which is offshore. And the amount of money involved is a little bit difficult to say, because it's very well hidden. It's hidden by the best people in the world at hiding it. But, you know, it's estimated by Global Financial Integrity, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., that $1 trillion, slightly more than $1 trillion, is stolen every year from the world's poorest countries and stashed in the richest ones, countries like, you know, your country or mine. And a trillion is one of those numbers, you know, a trillion, billion, million. I think we struggle to get our head around these big numbers that end in illion. But if you had $1 trillion in bills and you were settled down to count them, you know, $1 at a time, one a second until you'd finished, that would take you about 30,000 years. It's an incredible amount of money. I mean, if the first humans to arrive in North America had started counting the moment they set foot in Alaska, you know, they'd be about halfway to $1 trillion by now. And every year that much money is being stolen. And once that amount of money is being put on the sort of balance against democracy, that money is opposed to oversight, it's opposed to equal rights for all citizens because these people want special rights, then that is a profound threat to any kind of democratic order.
So to exemplify just a small bit of Moneyland, you use a company that was registered in the name of Rick Gates, Paul Manafort's business associate. And of course, Paul Manafort was Donald Trump's campaign manager, and before that was a close associate of Viktor Yanukovych when Yanukovych was running for the president of Ukraine. I think Manafort managed his campaign and then became an aide when Yanukovych became the authoritarian ruler of the country. So you trace like a shell company that was registered in Rick Gates' name, Manafort's business associate, and Gates cooperated with the Mueller investigation. And this company was located in what you describe as an unfashionable street in London. The company was named Pompolo Limited. So what was this company?
So Pompolo Limited was one of many companies Manafort used to essentially hide his money. He used, instead of owning his money in his own name, so when he bought, you know, an ostrich skin jacket or engaged the services of a sort of, you know, hi-fi shop, he, instead of it looking like he was doing all the buying, because that would have made the, you know, the tax authorities a bit suspicious, he used lots of little companies to do it. So it basically hid the fact that he was spending all this money. I mean, he had earned a huge amount of money in Ukraine, which he didn't pay tax on. He didn't want to pay tax on it, and was essentially then smuggling it into the US under the cover of legitimate money and then spending it on luxury goods. And Pompolo Limited was just one of these companies. It's based in a rather rundown and dull office block in Woodbury Grove in North London. And it was, I went there because it was in London, it was nearby. And I suppose you might hope that a nerve centre in the sort of Manafort empire, in this sort of very dramatic story of sort of skullduggery and high finance, would be interesting. But it isn't. It's a you know, when I went inside, I was shown inside by a man wearing an Iron Maiden t-shirt, you know, rather sort of scruffy guy. And I went into a rather scruffy office where nothing really happened. But it was indicative in essentially of the almost the mundane nature of the way that giant crimes are being enabled. You know, there are people doing ordinary jobs, you know, creating companies, opening bank accounts and so on. But in doing this and not doing the kind of checks that they should be doing on the origin of the money that they're handling, they're essentially enabling these vast crimes, which is what the book's about.
This office that you visited, what this office does is to create shell companies for people like Paul Manafort and Rick Gates?
It creates companies for anyone who wants them, really. You know, I'm sure they will tell you that they will do all sorts of checks on the origin of the wealth, and perhaps they do now. Who knows? They've been rather sort of humiliated by the Manafort connection. But yeah, essentially, this is a low margin, high volume business. You sell companies. Someone gets in touch. They want a company. You sell them one. That's it. You're done. You know, this is a very competitive market. There are lots of places all over the world. So Manafort had plenty of jurisdictions to choose from. And, you know, he had companies in Cyprus. He had companies in many different states of the US. He had in St. Vincent in the Grenadines and here in the UK. So he was using multiple countries, multiple jurisdictions to essentially hide what he was up to. So it was very difficult for any investigator to put the pieces together. And yeah, had Robert Mueller not started investigating the potential collusion, I feel sure that Manafort would have got away with this. He structured his assets very cleverly.
So these companies are what you call shell companies, right?
Yes, exactly.
So I don't really understand how you like buy a company. And then, of course, you can use that company to hide your money and buy things that you wouldn't want to be buying in your own name because that would trace you to ill-gotten money. So how do you buy a shell company? Like, I don't get it.
Well, it's funny because it is something that most of us have absolutely nothing to do with. But it's incredibly easy. If you were to use a search engine, type in buy a company, Nevada. Nevada's a good place to buy a company. You would see a whole list of people who will sell you a company. You drop them an email, give them a call, and they will just sell you a company. And there are sort of additional extras that come with it. They will sell you a company. You might get a company with a registered office. You might get a company with a bank account. If you're particularly resourceful, you can get a company with a registered nominee shareholder, nominee director, so no one can tell it has anything to do with you at all. But I mean, it is a... It's essentially an industry or business that most of us would have absolutely nothing to do with. But you can't commit financial crime without, essentially, on any kind of large scale, without shell companies. They are the building blocks for financial crime. And so they are incredibly useful for people like Paul Manafort, who are trying to commit these big acts of financial crime without being caught. And there's a whole business out there. There's all these sort of networks of agents. They're very easy to get. And, you know, if you need any, I could give you suggestions for a couple.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Hide my billions. So you mentioned Nevada is a good place to start a shell company. Why?
Nevada has very relaxed regulations on creating companies. It doesn't. A lot of places, like the UK, for example, now publish the identity of people who own companies. They publish a lot of information about this information online. You can just find it online. Nevada doesn't do that. It doesn't publish lists of its companies. It doesn't publish who owns its companies. And they're very cheap and very easy to get. Essentially, it's a revenue generator for Nevada. Nevada, it uses it to complement its budget. And I mean, it does well out of it. But I mean, I don't want to pick on Nevada particularly. I mean, Delaware does this too. Lots of other states of the union do very well out of essentially selling shell companies. In fact, it's got to the point when US companies are pretty much the best shell companies out there now, really. Compared to, it used to be places in the Caribbean, but they've slightly been cracked down on. So yeah, for the discerning international crook, I would say the US is probably the best place to get a shell company at the moment.
We're number one.
I'd say number one. Yeah, I mean, it's not all of the US. Some states are more difficult than others, but you know, these guys know their business. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say the US is number one now. I mean, there've been academic studies of, you know, where it's easiest just by going and asking people to create companies. And yeah, the US is way out in front when it comes to the ease of setting up a company.
So one of the things you do in London that ties in directly to your new book is a tour. What's the name of the tour?
These are the kleptocracy tours. They're a lot of fun. They're modeled loosely on Hollywood tours. I've never been to Hollywood, but I understand you can get on a bus and be driven around and they'll point out, you know, where, I don't know, Charlie Chaplin used to live or where Scarlett Johansson buys her lattes or whatever. And, you know, and it's a thing that tourists do and it's a lot of fun. So we decided to do these in London, but instead of pointing out the homes of, you know, the rich and the legendary, we point out the homes of the rich and the crooked, the kleptocrats, as it were. So we put people on a bus. We normally start at a site just near the House of Commons where the Russian Deputy Prime Minister has an apartment. and we point out his apartment, and then we put everyone on the bus and we drive around mainly West London, because that's a what might be called a target-rich environment for kleptocrats. And then we point out, it depends on our mood on the day, but you can talk about, you know, houses belonging to Nigerian governors, politicians from Kazakhstan, Russia, Ukraine, Angola, Libya. I mean, we're spoilt for choice, really. But it's sadly, we can only really do, you know, five or six properties at a time, because otherwise everyone would get exhausted. I mean, if we really wanted to keep going, we could probably do this for weeks and weeks and end without ever exhausting the variety of kleptocrat-owned property in London. London is very popular with kleptocrats.
If you wanted to expand the kleptocracy tours, you could probably expand them to the U.S. What would the best cities for the tours be?
We've talked about this. New York would obviously be a winner.
Yeah.
You know, New York and London are kind of the capitals of Moneyland. They kind of spar with each other. In fact, to be honest, from a Moneyland perspective, New York and London are kind of the same place. They sort of blur into each other. So New York would obviously be a winner up in sort of you know, Central Park West, I suppose, up there. But I mean, Miami, obviously huge too. Miami, particularly popular with your Latin American kleptocrats. It's been amazing to me, you know, if you watch the sort of the war of rhetoric between the government in Washington and the government in Venezuela, you know, this sort of war of rhetoric has absolutely not disrupted Venezuelan investment in top-end Miami real estate at all. The powerful Venezuelan elite, they'd love to put their money in Miami. So that would be a fun place to do it. In fact, have a sort of historical angle. You could go back to Al Capone as well if you wanted there. Los Angeles would be good. The deputy president of Equatorial Guinea, a gentleman called Teodoro Obiang, spent a lot of money in Malibu. So that would be quite fun. And then you could go up the coast to San Francisco. There's been a couple of good sort of investments there, including the former prime minister of Ukraine, a guy called Pavlo Lazarenko, who had a really nice place up in Marin County that I didn't visit because it's behind these high fences, but I had a bit of a look at it from a surrounding hill, and that was very nice property indeed, though he didn't get to keep it, sadly. He was put in prison and had it confiscated. But yeah, so those would be my kind of picks for the kleptocrat tour in the US. Obviously New York, then Miami second place, and then I'd say LA and San Francisco in a sort of kind of somewhere in third and fourth. I'm not sure which would come first.
Is that because these cities that you've mentioned are great places to live with, you know, wonderful, you know, palatial places to buy or to live? Or is it because of the laws in those places too?
These are obviously lovely places to be. But, you know, if you think about, if you're a crook and you've stolen a fortune, you're well aware of the fact that anyone in your country can steal a fortune. So they may be going to steal your fortune if someone else comes along who's bigger and more of a bully than you are. So, you know, it's a priority to get your money out of the country where you've earned it and where you've stolen it and get it somewhere, you know, where it's safe. So though they themselves love breaking the law and abusing, you know, their fellow citizens as much as they can for their own accounts, they don't want a country like that. So they depend on being able to get their money into a place with the rule of law. So that's why London is so popular, why New York is so popular. These are places where once you've bought property, it's very, very difficult to have that property taken away from you.
How have all the places in London where you live that are really owned by often absent oligarchs and kleptocrats, how is that affecting life in London?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because there are these sort of districts, I mean, places like Kensington, Knightsbridge, districts which were, you know, they were always kind of high-end districts, but, you know, ordinary British people lived in them in 20, 30 years ago. And yeah, they were a bit posh, but they, you know, weren't that unusual. But now you can walk around these places sort of in the evening and there are no lights on. There aren't really any shops, like ordinary shops. You know, there are lots of sort of boutiques, places where you buy, you know, Rolexes. You know, there's one point in Knightsbridge where you can see three Rolexes without even, you know, having to squint your eyes up. They're all within about 30 yards of each other. You know, these shops are everywhere. But in terms of an ordinary shop, the kind of place where you go and get a pint of milk, you know, these places don't exist in those neighbourhoods. There are no pubs because, you know, these people don't go to pubs. So it has changed the fabric of these districts, which means that not only is it too expensive now for any ordinary people to live there, but also ordinary people wouldn't want to live there because if you went there, there's no social life, there's no nothing. They're almost dead environments. And so what this is it's turned parts of our major cities, places like London and New York, it's turned them, they're now sort of essentially bank accounts. They're sort of, you know, bank accounts in the form of bricks and mortar.
Where does Donald Trump fit into Moneyland?
I think that, there's obviously a lot spoken about Donald Trump and his ties to Russia and all of that. And, you know, and to a certain extent, the jury is still out on a lot of that. I think that what I'm interested by this, by Donald Trump and by a whole class of property developers in the United States, of whom he is just one, is that since the financial crisis, they have become very dependent on money, on investment from foreign buyers. The sources of capital dried up domestically for a long time, and therefore they were dependent on money from China, money from Russia, money from elsewhere in order to finance the construction of this top-end, you know, real estate blocks. And that, to me, is the real scandal that actually I'm really surprised that the US media has not been spending more time looking at, is that there is a whole kind of class of businessmen, of whom Donald Trump is just one, who have been accepting money from very unscrupulous sources, many very shady sources, in order to get these projects off the ground. I think if you look at the EB-5 visa program, which is what brings, you know, foreign investment into the US in exchange for green cards, most of the applicants come from China, and yet it's very, very hard to check the origin of any wealth in China. There have been a couple of court cases in which people have been shown to be kleptocrats. I expect that there will be many, many more, and even that won't come close to exposing what's been going on. I think that there's been a remarkable and very worrying lack of concern, of interest, of diligence in the origin of the wealth that's going into these investment projects. So for me, that's how President Trump fits into Moneyland, is as a businessman, as a property developer. He has benefited from investment from some murky, obscure and shady sources. And I don't think there's been nearly enough scrutiny of where that money came from.
So in terms of Donald Trump's place in Moneyland, you quote a Reuters investigation about Trump properties. Can you just tell us a couple of things that investigation found?
It was in the sort of the early days of the Trump presidency, when there was a kind of journalistic feeding frenzy to find any, you know, connection between Donald Trump and Russia. And they went and looked at, you know, Trump developments and tried to find how many Russians owned properties in them. And they did. I mean, there were, you know, a few dozen Russians owned properties in these developments. And, you know, that was important. And it was good that they found it. But from my perspective, you know, it was far more interesting that more than 700 of these units were owned obscurely. They were owned via shell companies. So we don't have any idea who owns them at all. And that's where Moneyland comes in, because it's more than not knowing that's important. You know, these people, these 703 units which were owned obscurely, they could all have been owned by Vladimir Putin or President Xi or you know, the Chavez family or whoever. It's that secrecy that I'm concerned about, rather than the idea that there's a couple of dozen Russians. I mean, if you put your own name on a unit and you're a Russian oligarch, then you're a bit of an idiot, really. I mean, and they're not idiots. So anyone who owns a property in Florida in their own name is not going to be a top-ranking FSB agent or whatever. So that's the story which I think has not been focused on, is the way that people, it's so easy for people to hide what they're doing with their money, what they're buying with their money, and therefore where the money comes from, because you don't know who they are.
Oliver Bullough, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Oliver Bullough is the author of the new book, Moneyland.
Woke up feeling like I just might run for president. Even if there ain't no precedent. Switching up the messaging. I'm about to add a little estrogen.
Lizzo is a singer, rapper, and dancer who's also been playing the flute since she was in junior high. Prince was a fan and had her sing on his 2014 album, Plectrum Electrum. Lizzo's new album is called 'Cause I Love You, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's a diverse set of songs that showcase an immensely ambitious artist.
Yo, once upon a time I was a hoe. I don't even want a hoe no more. Got you something from the liquor store. Little bit of Lizzo and some more. Trying to open up a little more. Sorry if my heart a little slow. I thought that I didn't care.
Is anyone more fun to listen to right now than Lizzo? I think not. Her singing possesses a warmth that can't be faked or manufactured. Her phrasing is smoothly conversational, enunciated through a smile. Her big and bawdy songs are the kind of music heard on the radio or leaking through a bystander's earbuds that makes people say, "Hey, who is that?"
Mirror, mirror on the wall, don't say it cause I know I'm cute. Ooh, baby. Louis down to my drawers, LV all on my shoes. Ooh, baby. I be dripping so much sauce, got a bin looking like bread goo. Ooh, baby. Lit up like a crystal ball, that's cool, baby, so is you. That's how I roll. If I'm shining, everybody gonna shine. Yeah, I'm gold. I was born like this, don't even gotta try.
Lizzo is actually 30-year-old Melissa Jefferson. She was a child in Detroit, a teenager in Houston, and she moved to Minneapolis when she was a young woman starting her career. She's been playing the flute since her junior high school marching band days. And I have to say, the free-spirited flute solos I've seen her dash off on YouTube and Instagram videos have overcome my hatred for the use of this instrument in pop music, going all the way back to Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson in the 1970s. Many of Lizzo's songs feature lyrics intended to be inspirational in a way that is in keeping with someone who spent her youth, as she has said, being called, quote, "the chubby girl with funny teeth and a big girl with a cute face."
That's exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. I woke up this morning, wrong side of the bed. I don't have to explain it. I might be a bitch. I might make a friend. Ain't I so amazing?
For a while early on, Lizzo figured she'd be primarily a rapper. She claims not to know whether or not she had a good enough voice to sing melodies. Fortunately, she hooked up with some producers who wanted to hear what she could do with a ballad. The results, as can be heard on this song, Jerome, are superb. Lizzo has a sense of history. When it came time to choose a major label record deal, she says she signed with Atlantic Records in part because it had been the home of one of her idols, Aretha Franklin. When she wanted to include a fierce rap on her album, she opted to do it as a duet with another hero of hers, Missy Elliott. When she wanted to include a sultry ballad, she created the song called Lingerie, which sounds as though it could have emanated from a Memphis studio like Stax or Hi Records in the 1960s and 70s.
Hair down, moonlit, look at my lipstick, so thick, so fit, wanna put your lips in places, ooh, the sun don't shine there, I like that. Right there, keep going and going and keep it flowing, you know what you're doing, don't you?
As far as Lizzo's contemporaries go, I think one of the only logical comparisons to what she's trying to do is Bruno Mars, who has negotiated a pervasive pop stardom while retaining the credibility of his R&B roots. In her own way, Lizzo is trying for the kind of diverse mass audience that few artists attempt these days. She sounds as though she's never been more ready to take the big time by storm.
Ken Tucker reviewed Lizzo's new album called 'Cause I Love You. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The middle school years have got to be one of the most awkward periods of life. I don't know if many people would want to go back and revisit those years, but that's kind of what our guests Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle did. they co-created the Hulu comedy series Pen 15, in which they co-star as seventh-grade versions of themselves in the year 2000. In reality, they're both in their early 30s, but the rest of the show's middle schoolers are played by actual teens. Pen 15 explores what it's like for Maya and Anna to deal with puberty, mean girls, and their first sexual feelings. It's embarrassing, poignant, and very funny. And many of the stories come from Erskine and Conkle's real tribulations in middle school. A heads up to parents, this interview includes a couple of brief, non-explicit mentions about how they dealt with those kinds of sexual situations when they were that age. Pen 15 has just been renewed for a second season. Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip from the show. Anna and Maya are having a sleepover after Anna has just had her first kiss with her boyfriend, Brendan. And it's not how she fantasized it would be. Maya asks her about it.
And then, like, were your lips close together when you guys were standing close together?
Yeah. And then they touched.
That's like romantic.
No, it wasn't. Yep, it literally wasn't at all.
Why?
He put his lips like all the way around mine.
Ew.
And like sucked.
Ew.
It's not funny.
Wait, and then what? Was that it? Like she just sucked?
No, and then he put his tongue in my mouth and he like did like a torpedo cat tongue and like drilled my mouth.
Like what was it like? What did he do with it? Ew! Ew!
Yeah.
Stop!
I can't. I wish I could.
What did you do with your tongue? Did you do it back or did
it
just like
pin back? Like it was in trouble. You know?
That's crazy.
I know. It was awful.
I'm sorry. But at least you've, like, had your first kiss, you know?
I wish that I had it.
Say that.
I really do. Everything's just different. I don't know. I just have to break up with him, so.
Really?
Yeah. He's not the Brendan that bought us snacks at the bowling alley, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, the Brendan that drilled the back of my throat with his thumb. So. What's up to you to get the next boyfriend?
That's a scene from the Hulu show Pen 15, created and co-starring my guests Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
You know, those early teen years are such a strange time, and you have these bodies that are starting to sprout into adulthood, but you have minds that are probably not ready to handle that yet, and you're having to cope with these more adult situations. And the thing that makes it so worse is that your emotions are just so intense. Like, everything is just saturated and overwhelming. Like, just the way that teens respond to music. Like, it's so important, and it's like their theme music. So everything feels so consequential. And, you know, and then they're thinking about romance. So, like, everything is a powder keg.
Yeah, and there's so many misconceptions, too. Right. It's like, in real life, Anna, me, I thought kissing was going to be the ultimate feeling of romance. And, like, that's all I wanted. Like, I was not interested in sexuality at the time. I just wanted to, like, hold someone's hand and fall in love and kiss, like, Zach and Kelly on Saved by the Bell. So when the real version happened, which was just this weird tongue.
Yeah.
Like, just drilling me. It was a shattering of expectations, but and I think that's true in a lot of different ways, but you're fronting as though you either enjoy it or you get it or whatever. And there's a lot of sadness and humor that I think that comes with that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you create these beliefs of, you know, things lasting forever, like your friendships. I will be friends with this person till the day I die, and not realizing that things will change because you might go into different classes than your best friend, or you start developing different tastes than your best friend. It's
different trauma.
Yeah.
So, Anna, that scene was based on your first kiss, right?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, and what I found out recently, and Maya had a really similar experience, is I went home after my real first kiss, and I had been looking forward to it for so many years, and I was one of the last girls that I knew to do it. So I remember just being like, okay, I just have to do this, and I have to get out of the way. And then I did, and then I went home, and I told my mom, who I didn't tell anything to, and I cried. And I was like, I never want to do that again. Yeah.
Yeah, I had the same experience where I was a late bloomer with boys. And when I had my first kiss, I had the same expectation of it going to be this romantic movie-like kiss. And again, I don't know what's with these boys drilling their tongues.
Yeah, what are they watching?
I don't know. I don't know what they're watching.
I think they're watching something. I think that's what
they're watching. They're watching something. But yeah. I cried after as well, because I thought, in my mind at the time, I thought, oh, I guess that's what kissing is like. That's how kissing will be for the rest of my life.
Right. Yeah.
Could you describe what you guys were like in seventh grade? I mean, are these characters pretty similar to how you were?
I was the same and different. I think that the version of me in Pen 15 was more me in fourth and fifth grade. Mm-hmm. I think in real life by seventh grade, I learned to hide the things that I realized that made me, you know, a target. Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, I was full of contradictions. I was incredibly insecure and then brazenly confident at moments, delusionally so. I was incredibly whiny as a kid, and I think that comes through a lot as a way to get things. And I think my fear of letting go of childhood was a huge issue for me. I wanted to be an adult, yet I was really scared of losing my innocence, especially in front of my parents, because I equated innocence with love. So I thought if I maintained this childlike self then, or identity, then my parents would continue to love me the way they've loved me all these years. So that's a weird misconception that I created in my head.
Yeah, and that's played out in the show where Maya sort of becomes almost babyish in front of her parents.
Yeah, that still exists to this day at 31. I'm sad to say that I revert really easily in front of my parents, and I'm sure there's something that they're gaining from that too, which is something I'm exploring.
Sure.
Of why does this happen? Not to put the blame on them, but I'm like, why do you guys enjoy this?
It probably
this,
brings
you
them
know?
Back too, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys feel targets of bullies at that age?
I wouldn't necessarily call them outright bullies, but I had friends that would put me down a lot, and I didn't really comprehend what they were doing until years later. But yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily bullies that
outright
would...
Outright bullies, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a weird thing happen where... there was kind of a cycle in my school where the older girls would harass the younger girls. And that was even more in high school. But in middle school, there was a rumor that went around about me that I masturbated with an ice cube. It was really fun for me, that rumor.
Yeah.
And they came up with a really brilliant nickname called Icebox. Unfortunately, like, brilliant. And that followed me for, the next, really till I graduated high school.
That's awful.
And with it came this kind of sexualization of me that I wasn't ready for. Like, I was very much a prude at the time, you know, quote unquote, and wasn't going there. And yet there was this, like, thing there about me out there. And I was labeled as a slut, essentially. I mean, there are posters put up about me that said slut, and
really, wow.
Yeah, it got really extreme, and in other ways, like, I was simultaneously accepted. I mean, I had groups of friends and had found my place in high school, but that followed me.
You were saying that you felt like you were accepted too at the same time.
Yeah.
And in my memory, I wasn't accepted. But when I talk to people who went to my middle school, they always say, you seemed so happy, like you were friends with everyone and you were doing okay while I was going through this private misery, I guess. And I looked in my yearbook recently and I got overflowing messages of love. But in each message, it was, you are the cutest Asian I've ever met. Oh my God, I love you so much. You're the cutest Asian, Maya. Oh, screw those other Asians, you're the best Asian. You know, that was the majority of these messages in my yearbook. And I'm sure I took that in as a kid in my heart of, oh, no one likes me for me.
Well, you addressed that in one of the episodes called Posh, which has a really funny preface where you guys are doing like a public service announcement at your school, and there's like five girls. Some of them are like the scarier popular girls, and you're going to be the Spice Girls, but you're like, you're now elderly and you're suffering from osteoporosis and you drink milk, which makes your bones feel better, and then you can dance, right?
So
yes. It's very funny. But then, you know, Maya wants to be Posh Spice. These three other girls, not including Anna, says, well, no, you should be Scary Spice. And for people who don't remember the Spice Girls, Scary Spice is the only black member of that group. And they're like, you should be Scary Spice because you're tan. And you look the most like her. And Maya's like, well, okay, I guess. And then things start getting really bad. Like, the popular girl's like, you should bring us the milk because you should be the servant. And then they start calling you Guido the gardener. They're sort of like free associating like all the racist things that they can think of. Mm. And then, you know, your character doesn't know what to do because it seems like she's not totally clear what's going on. She's like, this is uncomfortable, but maybe I'll play along because the girls are laughing, so maybe I'm funny. She starts acting like how she thinks they want her to act, and it's really uncomfortable. And that's true, right, Maya? That's your experience, isn't it?
That did happen to me a lot, and I would play into that role really easily to become the jester, and I would make characters up and imitate my mom with a thick Japanese accent, and it would cause kids to laugh. And I thought, okay, I'm doing good. I'm a funny person because they're laughing at me, but really they were laughing at my mom's accent, the thick accent. And I didn't put that together as a kid, and it never penetrated me the way we show it in the show at the time, because you're just trying to survive. So yeah. I think we were trying to show, you know, a lot in 30 minutes, but what is that like when it's kind of hitting the person? And what is it like when you first realize for the first time that you're not like your other friends? You're not white. You don't sound the same. You don't look the same, even though this whole time you've held this belief that you are the same person, especially as your best friend. And so that moment of recognition in the mirror of, oh, I don't have eyes like Anna or those girls. Why don't I? I wish I did. And that hitting harder. That was something that I don't think I fully explored till we started writing this show.
Do you remember that first time when you felt that way?
I think I remember when I went over to a friend's house and we were putting makeup on, and when they would put eyeliner on, they had, you know, double eyelids, and so you could see the skin above the eyeliner, but when I would put the eyeliner on, it covered my whole eyelid. And oh, I'll get emotional thinking about it. Anna's crying too. And not having it look the same was such, it made me hate myself. I hated my eyes. I hated that I didn't have thick double eyelids like my friends, because that's all I saw around me. And I didn't have any ideals of beauties to look up to, really, when I was a kid growing up, of Asian beauties. Oh, Anna, so
no,
sweet.
No, don't make it. I'm sorry. So sorry. Yeah, it's not fair.
Let's talk about how you decided to actually play these characters yourselves. Like, why did you think that would work? You're women in your 30s, and you're acting like 13-year-olds, and the rest of the middle school actors are actually teens. How did you think that was going to fly?
I mean, we didn't know it would work necessarily, but we knew that if we wanted to explore a lot of the real things that happened to us at that age, we couldn't ethically or legally put 13-year-old actors in those positions.
Right, sure.
And then, you know, Anna and I were first actors, so we always approached telling stories through character, and it'd be great to be 13 again, you know, go through all of this trauma. But there was a lot of fear and questions of how is this going to actually work with real 13-year-old kids. And so we had to film a pilot, essentially, to see if it would work as mm-hmm. an experiment.
Yeah, I think it totally worked. Like, you look awkward and look insecure, and you don't look like everyone else. So that sort of embodies how you must have mm-hmm. felt at the time. And it's
exactly,
even funny,
yeah.
like, Anna, like, you like tower over all the seventh graders too. So, you know. Well, what did yeah. you guys do to your appearance and like physically to embody those younger versions? Like, what did you do in terms of makeup and just also how you held your bodies?
I had braces, and it was kind of like Invisalign with, you know, braces put on it, so it just slipped mm-hmm. in and out. But I did start using wax on set. It got very method because it starts, you know, scratching the inside of my mouth. And then we had kind of like binding straps on our chests. Mm-hmm. Maya always says, and I love this, that the jeans were always ill-fitting because they were for kids, usually, from eBay, and then the strap on the chest would, like, push your stomach in, you know, to the most pouchy sausage way that it could go, yeah. Which feels right. And then, for me, you know, again, something that I did when I was 13 was kind of casually always be blocking my stomach as though, you know, just hoping that everybody would just see me as skinny and not, they wouldn't know that I was trying to not bring attention to my stomach, essentially.
Right.
I was trying to hide it all the time.
Yeah, and I think I was just so physically uncomfortable, like you were saying, because I had to wear a wig every day, and I had this retainer put in. We put mustache
oh, yeah.
hairs and eyebrow hairs on ourselves, mm-hmm. In addition to the hair we have already.
Pre-wax, pre-tweeze.
I tried right. not to shave my face for months in preparation for this role.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
Let's go there.
But yeah, with the straps and the jeans, you're just so physically uncomfortable that it makes you self-conscious. And even though you want to have bigger breasts at that age, you also want to hide whatever is developing because it's not your ideal version of what you want.
Well, Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you so much.
Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle are the creators and stars of the series Pen 15. All of season one is streaming on Hulu. It's just been renewed for season two. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.